And welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. We are committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people directly to your earbuds. We're also very committed to bringing topics that are of transcendent importance to you. And today, I think we're going to talk about something that can't be surpassed in contemporary importance. We're going to talk about the 1619 Project. And we're going to talk about this project with Mary Graybar. I'll introduce her in just a moment, but let me first say this. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe, rate, review. It helps a lot. I'll just give you a couple of five-star reviews that I just recently saw, like 2 minutes ago. This is a fantastic podcast. Hank does a great job explaining complicated ideas in a way that everyone can understand, and he brings a humble and kind attitude to every conversation. I recently rediscovered Hank after growing up listening to the Bible Answer broadcast in our house. And here's another one from Wendy, who's also given us 5 stars. These podcasts are opening my mind, bringing clarity and remarkable content, truly worth listening to every episode. And the reason that these episodes are so worth listening to is not me, it's the incredible guests that I'm privileged to host on the Hank Unplugged podcast. But today is, as usual, no exception. This is an encore performance by Dr. Mary Graybar. She's a resident fellow at the Alexander Hamilton Institute for the Study of Western Civilization. She taught at the university level for more than 20 years, most recently at Emory University. And she's written some incredible books. If you listen to our podcast regularly, you've heard her. And she's incredible. She wrote the book Debunking Howard Zinn, exposing the fake history that turned a generation against America. And now she's followed that up with a book that we're going to be talking about today, Debunking the 1619 Project, exposing, and this subtitle, I mean, is so important, every word, exposing the plan to divide America. And I want to read something from the inside flap. If the United States is to be reimagined as an inherently racist regime, then Thomas Jefferson, the founding, the Declaration of Independence must be obliterated. In fact, no American hero's legacy can survive the 1619 Project's acid bath of lies. Even Abraham Lincoln, the great emancipator, is said to be intolerable, as is Frederick Douglass's celebration of America in his famous 4th of July speech. The aim of the 1619 Project is nothing less than to teach young Americans to hate their own country. This, again, from the back flap of Debunking the 1619 Project, Exposing the Plan to Divide America. If you don't have a copy of this book, it's available for those who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy by writing me at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. You can also get a copy on the web at equip.org. And with that, I am absolutely delighted to have Dr. Mary Graybar back on the Hank Unplugged podcast. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me again.
You are welcome anytime. And as I told you before we went on air, your writing is exquisite. And I know that you humbly credit your editors, but you are an incredible writer, very clear writer. But this is an incredibly courageous project. To take on the 1619 Project is no small thing, and I'm sure you have suffered greatly for doing so. I don't know if you want to start out by letting us know how this book has been received.
Well, it's been well received, you know, by people who, like you, You know, it's been mostly ignored by the left, by the very people who should, at least crack open and take a look at its pages and see what I have to say. Maybe they have and they just refuse to engage. But so far, no one has said there's, the critics have not said there's anything factually wrong in it. So a lot of the trolls are out there on Amazon giving it one star. So if you've read it and if you feel inclined, give it 5 stars or 4 stars or whatever you feel like, in order to balance the trolls, you can tell they haven't even opened it. But this is something that I saw when I was still teaching. It's an attempt to just demonize and to cancel people who don't go along with the political agenda. And, I've been canceled from teaching jobs. Fortunately, I landed here at the Alexander Hamilton Institute for the Study of Western Civilization, where I think I'm getting my revenge by writing these books. I was silenced during my teaching career. I would write these op-eds and try, and this was like 20 years ago. I'm trying, the stuff, critical race theory, the gender fluidity, all that stuff is very old hat to me. I was trying to write about that, or I was writing about that and like trying to shake people up and say, hey, look, this is what's going on at teachers' conferences. This is what's going on at in conferences for people who teach literature, who teach anything else, these academic conferences. And it's like, no, you're crazy. That can't be true. And here we have it. So it's I'm working on my third book now about a truth teller. He was a Black conservative, and that should be coming out early next year. And he faced the same thing. I'm working on a chapter right now where I talk about how he was canceled in 1936. So there's been this long line of people who are ideologues or left-wing ideologues. They just don't want to face the truth. They don't want to face facts. They refuse to be corrected. So, and I'm always willing to be corrected. I've had colleagues look at my work, gotten input from them. And so I pride myself on, being open to that criticism, accepting the corrections if they're valid, and continuing on.
Yeah, this is not about a we they siege mentality. I mean, this is about civilization hanging in the balance. This is about preserving the truth about America as a bright shining light on a hill, not a perfect civilization. No civilization is, but certainly a civilization that ought to be commended for doing the very thing that the 1619 Project condemns them for. And we'll get into the specifics of what I just said in just a moment. But if you will permit me, Mary, to do something in light of what you just said, I was thinking I might bring this up, I might not bring this up, but given what you just said, there's another scholar. And by the way, this is very interesting. Just today, I read an article by a scholar named Tom Mackeman. And it happens to be on the World Socialist website, no less. The title is American Historical Association President Issues Groveling Apology After Racialist Social Media Attack. And the story, as told by this scholar named Tom, is that we have the president of the American Historical Association, a man by the name of Professor James Sweet, is from the University of Wisconsin. He makes an innocuous criticism of the 1619 Project and ends up having to issue a groveling apology. So what did he do? He criticized the dominance of presentism in historical writing, which is, of course, the tendency to view history through the prism of contemporary social justice issues. And then he suggested that the 1619 Project's implication that slavery was a uniquely American original sin wasn't quite right. But then, in face of social media criticism, like, as a white man, he has no right to make critical commentary on Black or African history. In light of that kind of criticism, Professor Sweet crumpled, tweeting out an apology. I take full responsibility. I am deeply sorry. I sincerely regret. I hope to redeem myself. Hopefully we're not going to get anything like that from you.
No, I mean, you know, once you start down that path, you know, the next thing you know, there's going to be the firing squads. You know, we're seeing this. I mean, you know, we don't actually have gulags yet, but they've been doing this for years. They've been denying people who are critics may have legitimate criticisms. They deny them of their livelihoods. We're seeing it in healthcare now, and it's getting to be really bad. And it's people like James Sweet, you know, who refuses to acknowledge any kind of an agreement with someone who is not of his political persuasion, who is doing the damage, who is setting us down this road. It's just like, you know, under Stalin, his most devoted followers, you know, after they executed people, then they were the ones who were executed. I mean, this is the way it's going now. So, you know, people like James Sweet, who virtue signal and no doubt would have fired people like me in the past, would, if he, you know, I'm sure he sat on hiring committees, would not hire someone like me or, you know, people who are like me. Now he's getting it. And so, you know, you go down this path and it really does end in a very, very dark place. And I, you know, a lot of people feel sorry for him. I don't feel sorry for him. He's doing this to himself. He is trying to save his own skin. He's a coward, but he's not going to lose his livelihood. You know, I lost, you know, these adjunct teaching positions where I was just barely clinging on financially. But, you know, this is what's happening. You've got the mob out there. You've got people who are very ignorant. They're the ones actually teaching. And they're the ones who are doing the canceling. And a prime example is the 1619 Project, the creator, who is one of the most ignorant, and I mean that in terms of not having knowledge about her subject, as well as very bitter and willing to twist around things, you know, facts because of her bitterness.
So let's talk about the 1619 Project. What's the essence of 1619 as opposed to 1776?
Well, the word slavocracy is used. So this nation is presented as being a slavocracy. It falsely presents our founding not as being in 1776, but the arrival of the first Africans in Virginia in 1619. And from that moment on, Black people were either enslaved or were, you know, exploited for their labor. They are the ones who built up the wealth of this country. No credit is given to any white people. They finally showed evil white people the path out of their wickedness, their sin. You know, it's Blacks are without sin, the way it's presented. And so the founding needs to be understood as that moment. And we don't know exactly when that moment was. It was sometime in the latter part of August of 1619, when those first Africans arrived, because our country is built on the backs of the enslaved. Everything that is good about this country comes from them. Everything that is bad comes from the white people who were all, to some extent, exploiters. So that's the basic thesis. And as the creator, Nicole Hannah-Jones, had it on her Twitter homepage for at least a year, it's intended to eliminate 1776. She had it crossed out and above it was 1619. So that we should think of the founding of this country, which is really a slavocracy, is happening in 1619. All those principles that were expressed in the Declaration of Independence have no meaning. They just mark the hypocrisy of the founders who, you know, are presented as all being slave owners or profiting from slavery. And so everything is turned upside down in terms of what this nation is.
How can I trust you as opposed to Nicole Hannah-Jones? I mean, both historians, or maybe she's just a journalist, I don't know. But how do I know that what you're saying in this book is true and that what she's saying in the 1619 Project is false? I mean, is there a way of being able to vet a true historian as opposed to someone who's making it up, who essentially has a narrative, and that narrative causes everything to be conformed to that particular vein of thinking?
Well, I mean, you know, we have a whole body of knowledge. You know, I'm not Mary Graybar, and ideas are not springing from my head. I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. I'm looking to the great historians of the past. I've been fortunate enough here at the Alexander Hamilton Institute to get input from Bob Paquette, who's the president. He was a student of Eugene Genovese. There's a whole library here. I have colleagues. And so, you know, what I maintain is what's happened to scholarship is that there is no longer this sense of humility. There's no longer this intellectual curiosity to really find out what happened. And the 1619 Project, even if you just look at the style of writing, you can see that it's a polemic. It paints people as groups. And, you know, people are presented not as individuals who face challenges during their lives, who were born into certain circumstances, who had weaknesses and strengths. They are presented in a Marxist fashion as embodying the characteristics of the group that they happen to have been born into, their biological characteristics and their class characteristics. And so anytime you have a presentation of people that way, that's painted with broad brush strokes, and there's a paragraph that I quote from it where, you know, she writes, white people, you know, lynched, burned, beat, Black people, you know, so it's white versus Black. It's not, okay, this one individual did this, or this was the historical circumstance at the time where slavery and servitude were the norm. It's, you know, people of a certain group have these characteristics, and it's very Marxist. I mean, if you, you know, you had the kulaks and you had the proletariat. And so, you know, people were categorized that way. And so even if you don't understand slavery as a trans-historical international institution, and you don't know much about our founding, you can pretty much tell by reading, you know, the way the 1619 Project is written. It's not dispassionate. It's not even-handed. It's not fact-based. It's intended to rile up emotions. And it does so by purporting to present some historical evidence. But that is distorted as I show, as I do the research and go through these very, you know, well-known historians who have specialized in the subject areas. And Nicole Hannah-Jones has not. She is someone who is a journalist who has been writing about racial issues. And so she has been cast as someone who takes on this humongous project. I mean, it's so egotistical to say that you're going, you, Nicole Hannah-Jones, a journalist, is going to reframe all of American history. That, you know, just think about the hubris behind that.
Yeah, and I think it's also important, Dr. Graybar, to go back and point to the trail that you have left. I mean, I can look at your book and go back to primary sources. So I can see whether or not what you're saying actually comports with what the primary sources say. Primary sources, I'm talking about getting it direct from the horse's mouth. Mm-hmm. You've mentioned Nicole Hannah-Jones a number of times. Give us a little bit of a profile of this journalist.
Well, Nicole Hannah-Jones is, I think, about 46 years old or so. She has a white mother and a Black father, and she grew up in Waterloo, Iowa. She has talked about her past. And so I'm not, you know, revealing anything that's not public knowledge, but she grew up in a not, I guess, nice neighborhood, in a mostly Black neighborhood, which was kind of run down. She was bused to a white school from second grade on, a bus ride that took an hour each way, which I think is not something that little kids should have to do. And she noted, as she was, you know, getting closer and closer to her school in this white neighborhood, that houses were getting much nicer, things were cleaner, were kept up. And that sort of started her on her path of bitterness. She also reveals, you know, after this came out in an interview that I've pointed out, that her father was an alcoholic. And so he had some setbacks. I'm not doubting that he was discriminated against, but there are some other complications there. So she has this bitterness from growing up. And then I think when she was in 11th grade, she had this teacher in a Black studies class that gave her a book by Lerone Bennett. And Lerone Bennett was a magazine writer for Ebony Magazine. He was a radical leftist. He wrote this book called Before the Mayflower, which sets out the thesis of the 1619 Project, that, you know, before the Mayflower came, you know, you had this ship of people from Africa. But even he admits that there was, you know, that that slaves came from Africa, which had slavery, and, you know, and the Africans were selling the slaves. But anyway, she then was sort of transfixed on this thesis and, you know, sort of has this resentment, you know, which is, you know, something she's working out. She deliberately lied in the 1619 Project. She knows she's lying. I've caught her in her lies, and is now a very wealthy woman. I mean, it's incredible. In my book, I point out how much money she's made, you know, just from speaking at public universities. I've done several, you know, Freedom of Information Act requests, open records requests, for a year of her speaking. And she was doing at least twice a month and was getting at least $25,000 for an appearance for an hour, often remotely. I mean, it's incredible how much money she's been making. And then with the hardcover edition of the 1619 Project and getting prizes, she is a very wealthy woman. So this has been very lucrative for her. And she's not about to give it up and admit, you know, that she was wrong about certain things, if not most of the things she said.
Yeah, talk about this idea laundering issue, where a lie is repeated over and over and over again in peer-reviewed materials, and finally it becomes the truth. It's certainly morphs into truth. This idea laundering has really been a blight on academia.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, you mentioned James Sweet. There are certain things you can't say. You can't talk about the fact that it was Africans who raided other villages and marched people who were shackled together to the coast and sold them to Europeans. You can't say those things. You can't talk about the fact that a significant percentage of free Blacks in this country also own slaves. You know, that there are certain things that have become verboten in academia. And so we grow up with this idea. You know, I mean, when I grew up, I, you know, just thought, you know, we had invented slavery. You know, this, you know, I grew up in the North, and, you know, it was the bad Southerners who had slaves, and that's why we fought the Civil War, and it was all white versus Black. And I think it comes out of fear. You know, you will be ostracized in academia. You have to sort of toe the party line. You won't get a job. And if you do get a job, you will be at risk of losing it. And people, they like to virtue signal. They like to, you know, say, hey, look, I'm a great person. And Quite frankly, I think a lot of it has to do with white saviorism. I mean, that's a term that's been poo-pooed, but I've been thinking about it quite a bit, and it arises from the desire of many white people to, it's actually a way of treating people of other races unequally. It's a sort of a paternalistic viewpoint. You can't say that about those people. They've never done anything wrong because they haven't had any power. And so therefore they're like innocent little children. And that's sort of the attitude that has gained traction. And of course, there's always been the Marxist agenda, which is to divide and conquer along racial lines. I mean, as soon as the communists set up office in 1919, they set out to follow Lenin's orders and to, rile up, racial animus and, make things a lot worse. And, in order to point to, a sort of prejudice-free socialistic utopia.
Yeah, I want to get into why we know that the 1619 Project is a false narrative. But I also want you to comment on another article that my son gave me yesterday. And this is an interesting story. It all starts with a tweet, August 28, by Rachel Richardson. She's a Duke Blue Devil volleyball player, who says that she was targeted racially, that she was heckled throughout the entirety of a match against BYU, and she says that heckling was done by racial bigots. Then she accused BYU's coaches and the game's officials of having failed to take the necessary steps to stop the unacceptable behavior and create a safe environment. Then her godmother, Lessa Pamplin, who happens to be a criminal defense attorney who is running for judgeship in Texas, tweets this: "My goddaughter was called the N-word every time she served. She was threatened by a white male, told to watch her back going to the team bus." And then you have this tweet coming from this godmother who famously asked CNN why they consistently interview dumb, I don't know if I can say this word on the air, ASS, white women, and you poor white, I can't say this word, MFers, can't take it, and white women and men always disappoint. Imagine a Caucasian saying something like that. Then you have LeBron James saying to Rachel, "Be black, we have your back." Then you have Richardson's father corroborating the story, gives unqualified credence to the story. Then you have the governor of Utah, Spencer Cox, who says, quote, "I'm disgusted that this behavior is happening and deeply saddened. If others didn't step in to stop it, we have to do more to create an atmosphere where racist a-holes like this never feel comfortable." Then you have the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, Sports Illustrated, NPR, to list a few, all publishing predictable think pieces, despite the fact that there's no evidence that this has ever happened. And when I say this, first of all, BYU issued an apology, a contrite apology. Then they followed that up by saying, "We reviewed all available video, audio, security footage, raw footage from all camera angles. We reached out to more than 50 individuals who attended the event. We interviewed security. We interviewed fans." And then they say, "We found no evidence that any of this ever happened. And if anyone with evidence to the contrary wants to come forward, please do so and share it." This sounds like the Jussie Smollett story, but the reason I bring this story up is there's no investigative journalism. Everybody jumps on the story, it fits a narrative, it becomes popular, the person becomes famous, and there's a person who is mentally challenged who becomes the brunt of all of this. He's the one that supposedly did all of this. And then they had to issue an apology to him.
Yeah, I mean, it's, well, you know, these false historical narratives feed into this. You know, and it really, you know, I don't know what goes on, you know, like why someone like this athlete would do this. I mean, I think they've probably got some emotional or psychological problems. And it's a way to, you know, maybe they're starving for attention or something. But it's really an intimidation tactic. It's the way to get the whole system to come to your defense. And
well, she mentions, Mary, in her tweet that she had just gone through this incredible diversion, equity, inclusion seminar, and it really helped her to understand just how bad racism was in this country.
Yeah, I mean, that's feeding into it. And so you start off with something like the 1619 Project, which has been made into prepackaged lessons that complete with scripts for teachers and worksheets for kids, you know, beginning in kindergarten, and they're reading this stuff. And so when someone makes such wild accusations, you know, you've grown up with this stuff, your belief is, yeah, this country is really racist. There are people out there, you know, you've got the president saying we've got right-wing extremists who are basically terrorists. And so it's this vilification, it's this demonization of an entire race. And it's getting to be very dangerous, I think, because we've seen this, you know, talk about history. We've seen this in history before. And if you want to look back for examples, we have those, but those are not the ones that, you know, the proponents of critical race theory histories like the 1619 Project want to look at. And, you know, you mentioned narrative, and one of the things that I've seen in academia is the replacement of objectivity and the search for truth with narratives. It's your story. You know, what was your experience? Before I was blocked from Nicole Hannah Jones's Twitter account, she had somehow noticed me and we kind of had a few exchanges. And I said, well, this was, and I mentioned her personal experience, which she has been very public with. And I said, you know, well, that's really terrible to make a second grader, you know, sit on a bus for an hour, go away from her neighborhood and so forth. And, you know, I said something to the effect, I'm sorry you've had that experience, but that's not history. And she's like, oh my God, you know, you don't think what I went through is history? So it's this subjectivity, you know, what have I experienced? What has been my lived experience? Not, you know, let's take a look at the big picture. Let's look at the evidence. Let's try to be as objective. And so you get into these narratives and, you know, and it's really kind of crazy making these DEI workshops, diversity, equity, and whatever it is.
Inclusion.
Inclusion, right. So you start looking for evidence, microaggressions. I mean, that's a crazy concept, right? And so what is a microaggression? Is a microaggression from a white person ignoring you? Well, yeah, that could be a microaggression. Is it a white person being very friendly? Oh, that could be a microaggression. Is it someone looking at you a certain way? I mean, this is really crazy making. This is crazy making stuff. So maybe this athlete really believes it. Who knows? I mean, maybe she's exaggerating. Maybe she just saw something from her teammates and really misinterpreted it. And so this diversity, equity, and inclusion is making people paranoid. It's really making people almost hallucinate and imagine things, you know, and it's intended to do that. It's, you know, it's not intended to make people united, trusting. You know, if it were, we'd be emphasizing our commonalities, looking at, you know, really, what are the real, you know, characteristics, acknowledging, you know, what's gone on in the past, acknowledging differences, but not, you know, sort of making a mountain out of a molehill when it comes to interactions with people of other races.
So this 1619 project is clearly a false narrative, demonstratively a false narrative that slanders such people as Abraham Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson. And yet it's funded by taxpayer dollars. And as you alluded to just a few moments ago, it's now in some, I think the figure you used, 75% of the schools in America in terms of grade schools?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it has, you know, sort of seeped in so many different ways. You know, you had the Pulitzer Center that, you know, produced all those lesson plans for K through 12. They've put on these workshops for teachers so that they sneak them in, even in states where it's outlawed. I mean, I've observed these online and, you know, they share tips, which is what, you know, these leftist teachers tend to do when they get together. It's being distributed in libraries. There was a campaign for people to buy up multiple copies of the hardcover edition of the 1619 Project, you know, which is a 500 plus page book, plus a children's book, donate it to school libraries. The lessons are distributed by Learning for Justice, which is the educational arm of the Southern Poverty Law Center. There are these companies that are producing news programs at appropriate grade levels for students. They're incorporating the 1619 Project. So in some way, students are going to be exposed to it, most likely. I mean, and it's in the media, of course. And now there's this big supposed pushback claiming that, you know, that the states that are forbidding the teaching of it because of its historical inaccuracy are engaging in censorship. So I think this week is Banned Books Week. And so they're, you know, running with that. And of course, you know, the banned books are books like my book, you know, challenge you to find my books in any high school library or even, you know, just traditional history books.
You know, what's so troubling about all of this is you have someone who is as erudite and bright and sophisticated and highly positioned as Kamala Harris, who has praised the 1619 Project as, quote, a masterpiece. You have a U.S. Supreme Court Justice, Ketanji Brown Jackson, who promotes the 1619 Project and speaks of Hannah Jones as an acclaimed investigative journalist and says that this is a credible, reliable, historical piece of work. When they have all of the resources at their disposal to demonstrate that it is not. You have the New York Times. It is absolutely incredible how a lie can travel, to paraphrase Mark Twain, a lie can travel halfway around the world before truth has had the chance to put its boots on.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a willful distortion. You know, they've got to know the criticism that it's received. You know, they're both ideologues, and it's really scary to think that a Supreme Court justice is. And like I said earlier, there isn't this effort to engage, to go back and forth, which has been the traditional method in scholarship. It's to, you know, present your research to others, to colleagues, and to have this give and take and to, you know, defend what you say. The 1619 Project, you know, think about it. Why is it put in schools? Well, a second grader can't say, that's not true. You know, a second grader is someone who doesn't know anything yet and is easily manipulated emotionally. And you have teenagers, and they're manipulated through peer pressure. And so, you know, when you think about it, who does Nicole Hannah-Jones talk to? It's people who agree with her ideologically. It's college students. It's never with colleagues who are even mildly critical. So, you know, you're presenting this as if it were the truth. And the fallback that she has is that if you dispute anything she says, you are a racist. So it's a way to achieve power. It's propaganda. It's like Soviet propaganda. It's wiping out, you know, individuals from the historical record, you know, doing Photoshop, doing it in writing and in visual representations. And it needs to be called out for being that. It's not an alternative history. And one of the things I point out in my book, Debunking the 1619 Project, is Nicole Hannah-Jones pretends that she is the one, with the help of her high school teacher and Lerone Bennett, to have discovered this year, 1619. That's nonsense. It's something that Black historians, white historians have known. It's an area
that's been
that
celebrated.
It's been researched extensively by real historians. It's not something that she has uncovered as an investigative journalist or someone who has this particular genius for, you know, sort of unraveling the truth about history. It's been well known. There's nothing that is, you know, secret about it. It's a big sort of marketing project. And, you know, she had the help of the New York Times, these billionaires funding, you know, left-wing nonprofits. And it came out at an opportune time because, you know, the following year we had the 1619 Project riots, you know, ostensibly about, you know, the death of George Floyd. But, you know, from all the historical monuments and statues that were attacked, it seems to have nothing to do with George Floyd. So it is something that has very little to do with history. It has a lot to do with propaganda, and it has a lot to do with marketing and big money behind it.
Let's get into the details of that. Hannah Jones contends that slaves at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello plantation, which was near Charlottesville, Virginia, struggled under a brutal system of slavery, quote, unlike anything that had existed in the world before. You say that that is an error of such magnitude that only a profound ignorance of history can excuse it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, where do you begin with that, you know? And so, you know, in that chapter that takes that phrase as its title, I tried to go back and give an overview of the practice of history, you know, since time immemorial, and how universal it was. It's been practiced by all major religions and all continents where there have been human beings. It was the norm. In 1776, you know, most people were either enslaved or in some form of servitude at that time. The idea of freedom was new. So, you know, where do you begin with that? But what she's banking on is the fact that this is not discussed in schools. And I used an example of, you know, attending an OAH teacher workshop at the Organization of American Historians. And there was a teacher there who had mentioned, well, less than 5% of the transatlantic slave trade went to the American colonies. And she was told Oh, don't tell your students that. You know, what they want is students to have this idea that it was, you know, only the colonies, the American colonies, and then the states that had slavery, and that all the people that were taken from Africa, supposedly kidnapped by whites. And I show that that's not the case. It was tried. The Dutch tried it. And they were soon slaughtered. And they gave up on that idea when they did do it. And that was very rarely they would have to get tribes, African tribes, to help them. So there were always Black people involved in, you know, getting the slaves, the African slaves, in the first place. So, you know, that's such a glaring omission, but it has to be there in order to promote the thesis that this nation was founded as a slaveocracy, and it remains a slaveocracy to this day. You know, in so many respects, there is still racism. Black people are still oppressed, and therefore we need reparations. And that's, you know, that's the purpose of the 1619 Project, is as a historical argument for reparations.
I think one of the things we have to get at here is that the most radical thing is not that America participated in slavery. The most radical idea that ought to be underscored is the abolition of slavery. Because slavery was pandemic. It was part of human civilization. It has always been part of human civilization because of greed, because of avarice, because of the sin that runs through the center of the human heart. So the abolition of slavery is something that we ought to take great, great pride in, not just as Americans, and certainly you can talk about Wilberforce and many others that were involved that gave their lives for the abolition of slavery. And certainly Thomas Jefferson, he moved expeditiously to end the Atlantic slave trade with the help of Congress. So rather than defacing his statue or trying to excise him from history or trying to say that the Declaration of Independence was a racist document and he was a racist himself, instead of saying that, we ought to be saying exactly the opposite, that this was one of the great shining moments in American history where you had leaders who were wanting to abolish something that they recognized was hideous and heinous and ought to be abolished.
Yeah, I mean, I make the argument that he has been known as the Apostle of Liberty, and he deserves that title, and we should still think of him that way. And I tried to provide some, you know, stories about the obstacles he faced, the situations he was in his time and place, you know, in terms of trying to figure out a way to end slavery without war. Because, you know, as he said, you know, you've got the wolf by the throat, you can't let him go, and you can't keep holding him. It was a problem. It was something that he could not figure out. And on a personal level, you know, he was born into a slave-owning family. His father died when he was 14. He soon had the responsibility of taking care of his mother's plantations and the slaves. And he hated the institution. He did not enjoy, you know, seeing people enslaved. And as far as the slave owners went, you know, someone who was enslaved by Jefferson probably was much better off than with a lot of other slave owners, including Black slave owners who were in Virginia and elsewhere.
Why has that largely been expunged from textbooks, the fact that there were Black slave owners?
It's, you know, for political reasons. It's this attempt to, you know, and I think it's very complicated. It's this attempt to present, you know, a group of people as childlike, to say that they were incapable of doing anything bad, which to me is very insulting, because it implies that, you know, you need to be taken care of and you're like a child. And I think you have these radical leftists who agitated, especially in the 1960s. And one interesting thing I found was that when you go back to the early Black historians like Carter Woodson and Benjamin Brawley, I think it was, and John Hope Franklin in their Benjamin Quarles, when you go to their scholarship, you'll see that they were so much more honest than a lot of these, you know, Africana studies and Black studies professors. They readily acknowledged the complicated situation back in the 18th century. They readily acknowledged the fact that it was the Africans who went and captured Africans of other tribes and sold them. You had Frederick Douglass, who had referred to the, and I'm quoting him, the savage native chiefs of Africa who were doing that. You had much more honesty back then, but then I think in the 1960s, you had radicals in academia, and they, you know, used, you know, presentism, they used history for, you know, social justice ends. And so history became twisted around. And so it's become accepted. And if you keep saying that, you know, you think about it, since the 1960s, we've been told the same story over and over and over again. And eventually, the real story gets forgotten. And those who dare to bring up the old story, like I do, are called racists. So, you know, we need to push back against that. And I deliberately, you know, use the research of these, you know, distinguished and very accomplished Black historians from 100 years ago in order to make this point.
I think you mentioned a phrase that bears some illumination and unpacking. You mentioned the phrase, the wolf by the ears, which is a title of one of your chapters. Jefferson actually said, we have a wolf by the ears, and we can neither hold him nor safely let him go. Justice is in one scale and self-preservation in the other. And that underscores the fact that this is a tricky situation. Jefferson hated slavery, but he was, as this phrase aptly puts it, he was in the position of holding a wolf by the ears.
Yeah, I mean, after the Haitian Revolution, you know, which is lauded by Nicole Hannah Jones and her allies, you know, where you have a majority Black population, as sometimes there was in the southern states, or close to a majority Black population, you know, there is a very real danger there, you know, and the tragedy of the Haitian Revolution, as Gordon Wood points out, is that just as we were moving to abolitionism, we have the Haitian Revolution, and you have all these people swarming over here, and, you know, bringing their own enslaved people who are inspiring, you know, Blacks here to become violent. And suddenly the sentiment for abolition is thwarted because, you know, rightfully, you don't want, you know, whole communities wiped out where you have these roving gangs slaughtering women and babies in the middle of the night, which is what happened in Haiti. So, you know, what do you do? How do you stop it? One of the things was to end the Atlantic slave trade. Okay, let's start there. And Jefferson, as president, made sure that that was done. You know, he wanted to end slavery incrementally. He did not want a war. And, you know, it's always better to make changes without bloodshed. And unfortunately, you know, he wasn't able to do that, nor were a lot of other people who wanted to as well.
If you go back and read the original draft of the Declaration, it's very clear that Thomas Jefferson was profoundly, deeply disturbed by slavery. He wanted to abolish slavery. I don't think there should be any historical consternation about that. It's absolutely plain and clear. But as you say, I mean, this kind of radical change requires a balancing act, and that's where he was. I want you to speak to the falsity of Hannah Jones' claim that Jefferson never actually intended to abolish slavery.
Well, I mean, she has nothing to base that on. She hasn't gone through his writings. And the claims that she makes in the 1619 Project aren't based on any real research. You know, we've got historians that spend their, you know, lives looking at this and have come up with the opposite conclusion of Nicole Hannah Jones, but she refuses to look at that evidence. And so she pretends that she is able to read the hearts and minds of these people in the past. And she hasn't done her homework. She's not a historian. She's acting out of resentment, you know, but it's not scholarly curiosity. She doesn't want to know the truth. And the 1619 Project is a polemic. It's intended to be an argument for reparations. She believes that white people owe her something, even though she, you know, she is a celebrity now. You know, no academic could ever hope to achieve what she has achieved in terms of influence and in terms of money. So, you know, it's just propaganda. It's propaganda masquerading as history. It's the kind of propaganda that Howard Zinn put forth. He and Hannah Jones use these rhetorical tricks. They pretend that they are uncovering something that's been secret. And I think people naturally want to know, oh, wait, is there something that, you know, people have really been trying to keep secret? And especially teenagers, adolescents, right? Oh, you know, your patriotic story is completely false. They like that. And so these two people are propagandists. They're pretending to be historians or to be writing about history, but they're not. They're twisting it around to their own Marxist political ends.
What about the narrative that Thomas Jefferson fathered Black children?
That's wrong. It hasn't been proven. I mean, I go into that quite a bit because that's something that's being promoted by Annette Gordon Reed, who is on the same side with Nicole Hannah Jones. It's at the Monticello website, but it's false. I mean, these are people who believe in science with a capital S, you know, and as I, you know, briefly described, you know, there was a report put out by 13 historians who are Jefferson authorities, and they came to the conclusion, except for one mild dissent, that historically speaking, Jefferson did not father any of Sally Hemings's children. And the DNA evidence shows that there is about a 7% chance that he could have been the father of her youngest child, which he would have had to have fathered when he was 65 years old. And then the family did not allow further DNA testing that would have confirmed that. So you kind of have to wonder. But yet this myth is being put forth, you know, at Monticello, which is often cited as, you know, being a truthful source. And as I've written about recently, you know, Monticello itself, now the tours, the displays, the website is slanted. And that the idea that Jefferson fathered Sally Hemings's children, that was a rumor that was started by a political enemy. It was treated as such by legitimate historians. And then it was revived by Von Brody in the 1970s. And then it was picked up again by the other historian. She's not a historian. She's really a legal scholar, Annette Gordon Reed. And now the 1619 Project is taking off with it. So it's really outrageous, the way that has come to be accepted as fact. It would take an extraordinary uncovering of evidence to show that Jefferson, had fathered all her children. It just isn't there. And the evidence points to the opposite. So that is a falsehood that is being perpetuated over and over again.
Kind of like the myth that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene. I want you to talk about Abraham Lincoln. I think this is one of the most horrendous parts of the 1619 Project. Lincoln is denuded of his title as the Great Emancipator. He's also now diminished in the eyes of so many millions of Americans. And I think that's one of the most horrendous things. I've spent a lot of time reading Abraham Lincoln from the horse's mouth. And for him to be sullied by Nicole Hannah-Jones is just beyond the pale.
Yeah, and a lot of it has to do with innuendo and putting undue focus on certain small events and ignoring other things like the Lincoln-Douglas debates or what Frederick Douglass thought of Lincoln, just focusing on, an event like when he met with, I think it was five distinguished Black men about colonization, which was, it's a complicated matter, but it's presented in the 1619 Project very simplistically as Lincoln wanted to just ship every Black person off to some, hot place where they would perish. it wasn't that way at all. Colonization was something that a lot of the free Blacks themselves believed in. And it was one of those situations for Lincoln, that presented itself at that particular time. He, knowing that, Blacks would not be accepted as equals in many places in America, tried to find, a solution. And it was also something that Jefferson thought of. He thought, a lot of people thought that colonization was a form of repatriation, that, this group of people would be happy to be back where they came from. I mean, that wasn't the case. And it's also the innuendo. One thing I noticed about the scene that she presents where Lincoln is meeting with these men and she presents him as towering over them, and as if he's some kind of ominous figure that's threatening them and forcing them to encourage colonization. And certainly if you read Frederick Douglass, you will see that Lincoln did not come across that way. And what I tried to show in debunking the 1619 Project is what is left out. And what is left out is how Lincoln treated Frederick Douglass, and, which was very radical for the time. And Douglass's own accounts, describe Lincoln as, having a meeting with him, letting him go to the front of the line as all these men were sitting there on stairwells, so many people trying to visit with Lincoln and talk to him. And Frederick Douglass is ushered right in. You won't see that in the 1619 Project. And of course, here we have a president who was assassinated for, his position. I mean, that's not enough. I mean, if that's, not something that's acknowledged, well, what is, And that's, the big objection to the 1619 Project. There are no no good white people there. There's no acknowledgement that, you know, abolitionists suffered deprivations and sometimes were killed. It's presented in very racialist terms that it was Black people alone who won their freedom. And that is a demonization of a certain race of people. And it's, you know, based on falsehoods, because there are so many. And I, you know, of course, I couldn't go through all of history, but I tried to show, you know, that there were so many white people, including many Southerners, who were opposed to slavery and who did try to do what they could and sometimes gave up their lives doing it.
One of the points that you make in the book is that Douglass called Lincoln, quote, one of the noblest men who ever trod God's earth. That's not something you'll hear from Nicole Hannah-Jones. Something else that I think is worth pointing out, you write on page 194 of your book, and I'm quoting here, after talking about Lincoln debating pro-slavery Senator Stephen Douglas, you point out that Lincoln's principles were so well known that seven Southern states seceded from the Union out of fear that his election as the first Republican president was a mortal threat to the institution of slavery.
Yeah. So, yeah, and we had a war over it. And that is, you know, I mean, true, Lincoln wanted to keep the Union together. That was his, you know, objective, his main goal, but he also wanted to end slavery. So it was very complicated, but there is no acknowledgement, you know, of that. So when you look back on history and you look at it honestly and see what the worldwide situation was, and what our leaders were doing and the paths they were making, and there is no acknowledgement of that, well, then that's a history based on lies.
You talk about the context. I mean, in the 18th century, had Scottish empiricist philosopher David Hume rendering blacks naturally inferior to whites. You had Charles Darwin, who reasoned inequity or inequality to be a self-evident truth. And in view of that context, that historical context, you have eugenics being popularized by the founder, the birth mother of Planned Parenthood. And yet you have Lincoln saying, if slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong. And I think another point that ought to be underscored, if you could, is that Nicole Hannah-Jones seems blinded by her allegiance to the Democratic Party, and there's nothing mentioned whatsoever about the reality that the Democratic Party in those days was the party of slavery.
Yeah. You know, I honestly, you know, I think about it, you know, I think, you know, what would Nicole Hannah-Jones have done, you know, in the 18th or 19th century, if she had the opportunity to own slaves, you know, and a lot of these critics. So, you know, I mean, their argument is that the parties have changed, that, you know, since about the civil rights movement, that the Democrats are the people who are for liberation and equal rights. But Nicole Hannah-Jones is a far left Democrat. She aligns politically with the squad. You know, if you look at her Twitter feed, she's always retweeting things that, you know, AOC would agree with and that group of women. So she can't see out of those, you know, she has those ideological blinders on. And it's unfortunate. I mean, she can have those, but she shouldn't be writing distorted history that's then taught to school children and college students.
Yeah, I think another thing that you point out in the book is at the time of Lincoln's assassination, Democratic newspapers were printing racial slurs, and even before his inauguration, Lincoln was getting death threats. And as you pointed out earlier, he was ultimately assassinated by John Wilkes Booth, who was a Confederate sympathizer.
Yeah. And that was, you know, after he heard a speech where Lincoln, I think, was proposing giving certain black men the vote. And, you know, he was enraged by that. So, you know, and you also have to take into account the time that Lincoln was living in. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, the 1619 Project does is it applies our standards today to, you know, what was going on then. You know, of course, today we would say, you know, it's no big deal to allow black men to vote or black women or women or anybody. But as far as that goes, you know, Lincoln was far, far ahead of his time. And that should be acknowledged. And I think from a certain personal perspective, he hated slavery. I mean, he was from a poor family. He was hired out by his father. He knew what it was like to, you know, have someone else take the money that you've earned by the sweat of your brow. When he was working, I think he had a raft to transport people down the river. He saw these slaves shackled. He was deeply struck by that. He hated the sight of that. You know, and it affected him profoundly. There are a lot of people who are not, you know, but he was.
I always say contrast is the conduit to clarity. We spoke about the Declaration of Independence, which was the conscience of the Constitution, but contrast Frederick Douglass's faith in the founders of the Constitution, and he was a black man, obviously, we've certainly underscored that, with Hannah Jones' assertion that the framers carefully constructed the Constitution to preserve and to protect slavery.
Well, there was a compromise there. You know, if the people who did not like slavery insisted on getting their own way, there would never have been a constitution. And so, you know, that's the nature of politics. You have to have compromises. And, you know, Frederick Douglass's later interpretation of the Constitution is that, you know, it was a glorious liberty document. He had changed his views, and I mentioned that briefly, but, you know, he said that interpreted the way it's, you know, it should be interpreted at what, you know, was a glorious liberty document. And of course, you know, we've had the amendments and it's been changed. So Nicole Hannah Jones is twisting around the Constitution and, you know, wants, or her own political reasons, wants people to believe that though there was slavery at one point, that not much has changed in this country, that fundamentally we are still a country that exploits a certain group of people, and it's time to pay. It's time to pay through reparations. And in her hardcover book, you know, her final essay of this collection is on reparations. And she came out with an essay in the New York Times titled What is Owed? And what is owed is reparations, according to her.
Yeah, and oftentimes reparations have been talked about in terms of giving African Americans their own state. I mean, you talk about colonization. I mean, that's been talked about in the present.
Yeah, that was something that was proposed by the communists. It was proposed in the 1930s. Then there was talk of that again in the 1960s. And so that's an old idea, you know, to have a separate state. So that's a form of colonization as well. So that's nothing new.
Yeah, nothing new. I do want you to comment as we start wrapping this up. I want you to comment on the kente cloth, a cloth that was worn by wealthy African slave traders. And now you have Nancy Pelosi, you have Harris, you have Chuck Schumer, you have Booker, you have Nadler. They're wearing that. Why would politicians wear that, gather in the Capitol's Emancipation Hall, wear a kente cloth that was worn by wealthy African slave traders. I don't get that. I've been trying to figure that out.
Yeah, that's that. I mean, I remember that scene. It's ludicrous. I mean, it's something that really, you know, we should do comedy about. In their ignorance and in their virtue signaling, this was during the summer of George Floyd. It was so funny because, you know, Nancy Pelosi, you know, then they're kneeling, right, for I don't know how many seconds it was, or
I think it was 8 minutes and 46 seconds.
That's right. That's right. And they had the seconds down. And so they're kneeling, and then Nancy Pelosi couldn't get up. She needed help. Jerry Nadler couldn't kneel at all. He's standing there. And, you know, there was this Washington Post column that was written by a woman, forget which part of Africa she's from, and she was offended by this, you know. And also, these were the kinds of cloths that were used for celebratory occasions, not for mourning. So they didn't even know what kind of, you know, cloth to appropriate. So talk about cultural appropriation. It's ludicrous. I mean, can you imagine if Donald Trump had done that? Can you imagine the outcry? How dare he put on one of these cloths? How dare, you know, any Republican do that? I mean, it's all virtue signaling, and it shows you just how really disrespectful these people are of real culture and real history. It's an attempt to sort of, it was just pure virtue signaling, and it was done very ignorantly. There was no, you know, you would think that people with staffs like Nancy Pelosi, they could get somebody to research this, right? And to find out, well, what's the appropriate, if you're going to use this, you know, is it an insult to have a white person wearing this? But you're not going to hear any complaint from Nicole Hannah Jones about this. Now, if a Republican did, I would bet you good money that she would be tweeting about it. She would be outraged about it. But if someone on the left does it, it's okay. And you will never hear her criticize, you know, someone even who on the left who dresses in blackface, as, you know, Trudeau did and the former governor of Virginia did. You won't hear a peep. So this shows you that the real concern is not Black history, because there's no respect for the Black historians that came before and the Black traditions that had already acknowledged 1619 through various means, through poetry and through ceremony. There is no real respect for Black history.
There's no respect for history, period. I mean, one of the things that you point out in the book is that Marx has made the point that the institution of slavery made America great. And therefore, today, we've kind of followed that narrative that It was Marx. He writes the institution of slavery made America great. And therefore, you can't say today, make America great again.
Yeah. Well, right. I mean, it's, it's the old thesis that, you know, it's the Marxist thesis that, you know, the labor was expropriated from the slaves, and, you know, we cannot say that America is inherently great. It has to be, you can't celebrate America. You can't have 4th of July celebrations anymore. You have to have dirges. You have to have ceremonies that, you know, just remind us of, you know, people who had suffered before. So, you know, America is not great, according to the 1619 Project, for sure. It's terrible.
How critical is it to have an antidote like your book? I mean, I obviously would promote this book. I've read it carefully. I followed the threads. Our research department has looked into the authenticity of what you've written.
Oh, good.
So I can stand behind this book, debunking the 1619 Project, exposing the plan to divide America. But I want to sort of end with your take on how we can do something about this. Do you try to remove a book like this from schools? In other words, are you for censorship, or do you think that's just the reverse ideological iron boot? You try to shed light on this. I don't think you're for censorship, are you? You're for shedding light on this and bringing this out in the open so you can have an open and honest debate.
Well, you know, it's a false notion that the people who want to take the 1619 Project out of classrooms are for censorship. I mean, I think most people would agree with me, you know, if you had the 1619 Project, New York Times wants to publish it, Penguin Random House wants to publish it, fine, I don't care. But when it's put into schools, that's where we have a problem. And we know it's false history. And we know it's history written in a way to inflame and to divide. That's its purpose. And by the same token, we would agree. I mean, there, you know, 2015, I think it was, and I think I use this incident in my book, a woman, a mother, a Black mother, her son had brought home his history book, which referred to the enslaved people as workers. I mean, in other places in the book, they were acknowledged as slaves, but in one use of the word workers for enslaved people, and she objected, and this was a major publisher. They agreed to change future editions. Okay, it's costly to make those changes. This was one word. The change was made. And by the same token, if the textbook had glorified slavery and said that these people were all happy and dancing and they liked being slaves, we would say, wait a minute, we're not going to teach that in the classroom because that's wrong. So if you're willing to take out a history book that is wrong in that respect, you should also want to take out a history book that is wrong in the other respect. So they're being inconsistent. They insist that, you know, the old textbooks that were, you know, influenced by the Daughters of the Confederacy were horrible. They presented a false picture. Those should never be taught. Well, the 1619 Project presents a false history, so it should not be taught. And if people want to go out and buy it, hey, you know, let them do it. You're an adult. You can use your money for what you want to purchase. And by the same token, I would also say, you know, allow my book and others that have provided a counter to it to be out there as well.
And you have Twitter and YouTube so often censoring information that they consider to be false information. So they want to look at that information, they want to vet that information, and then they want to repress it if it is indeed false. Now, in a lot of cases, what they consider to be false doesn't turn out to be false. They haven't done their own good research.
Yeah, it's purely ideological. And, you know, I think it is Banned Books Week or something. And Nicole Hannah Jones is making a big speech in Virginia. And, you know, that's her latest campaign. But I would like to see how many school libraries have my book or other similar books. You know, I can guarantee you that they, you know, that there are so many woke librarians that they've been, you know, accepting these donations of the 1619 Project book, but students rarely have the opportunity to even see that there is an alternative there. I mean, they're taught the 1619 Project. It's, you know, given to them by their teachers. And so they think, well, that this is true, you know, and, you know, my hope is that somehow, you know, these students, their parents, citizens will have, you know, a resource where, you know, they can go to, and I've done the research, and they can say, yeah, this part of the 1619 Project is wrong. It's false. And on that basis, you know, it should not be part of the curriculum. And this is what the story of America really is. And we should be proud of America. And as someone who, you know, came here as a very young immigrant from a communist country, you know, I can say, you know, as Lincoln said, that this is the last best hope. And we should be instilling that idea in our schools with an accurate history, you know, that presents, you know, what actually happened.
Let's wrap this up by talking about your paperback edition, which has some inclusions, including the fact that Nicole Hannah-Jones had to make a lot of corrections. She had to walk back a lot of what she said in the original project.
Yeah, there were stealth edits, you know, and those were done by her editor. And, you know, there are many other historians who have criticized the 1619 Project, Gordon Wood and, you know, Sean Wilentz, these very distinguished, accomplished historians, you know, from both the left and the right and the center politically who have criticized it. And she knows that there have been criticisms. And so, you know, in the months leading up to the release of the hardcover edition, which is just an expanded version of it, it's, you know, there are more creative works, you know, what they call poetry and sort of, I don't know, responses to historical events, and there are essays. But in the months leading up to the release of that book last November, Nicole Hannah-Jones was bragging that there would be 1,000 endnotes. This was going to be scholarly. And once and for all, it would answer her critics. And so I got a copy of the book, and I looked at the endnotes. I did a deep dive. And come to find out, the vast majority of those endnotes are not legitimate. The people who are cited are ideologues themselves. They're not reputable historians. The reputable historians that are cited have their words taken out of context and distorted. There are references to things like websites and to conversations that don't really back up the points that are being made. So it's not a scholarly work by any stretch. And so what I do in the paperback edition, I have a 35-page appendix where I investigate those endnotes and the changes that were made. And you probably noticed that there were certain words that were struck out, and she modified her claims in accord with, you know, the criticisms. Of course, she didn't acknowledge those, but I did. I, you know, pointed out the words that had been changed, things that were left out. So, but that was never acknowledged. And usually, you know, you do acknowledge that you've been corrected and that changes have been made. So it's like the stealth edits on the website. It's a very dishonest way of presenting history and scholarship.
Well, you are an incredible resource. This is an incredible resource. We have the paperback now, as you have described it, Debunking the 1619 Project, Exposing the Plan to Divide America. Must reading, available for all of you who stand shoulder to shoulder with me in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy by writing me at P.O. Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. You can get your copy by going to the web, equip.org. And this is absolutely, I mean, oftentimes, Mary, I see these yellow buses picking up kids. I walk in the morning and I pray and I memorize, and I see these kids getting on the buses, and sometimes I think, oh my goodness, they're going to an indoctrination camp, in essence. And there has to be an antidote, and this is an incredibly powerful antidote. Again, it's well written, it's interesting. I mean, if you can't remember details about Thomas Jefferson or Abraham Lincoln or Frederick Douglass, you know, if you don't remember the Declaration of Independence, which kids used to memorize, you go through this book and you get this incredible information. It's presented in an intoxicating fashion. I couldn't stop reading the book. I mean, I actually read it Then I reread it, underlining it, and then I go through with a yellow marker, and I've done that with your book, and I feel like it's imprinted on the tablet of my consciousness. It's a fabulous resource. You are an incredible historian. You're brilliant. You're bright. And I appreciate your contribution, not only in writing, but also in the Hank Unplugged podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This has been delightful. And I hope my book helps, you know, getting the truth out. And I really appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure. It was truly an honor to host you today.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to this edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. We look forward to seeing you next time with more interesting, informative, inspirational people and the things that they talk about. That's of quintessential importance. And this book is a representation of that. You've got to get it. You got to read it. You got to get in the hands of your kids. Talk to your kids about it. Make a difference while there's yet time. Thanks for tuning in.